The Internet Bar, Building the Global Justice System with Jeff Aresti. That is our topic for today. Welcome to the Lawyers and Mediators International Show and Podcast, where we discuss law and conflict resolution topics to educate both professionals and everyday people. Catch regular episodes on YouTube and anywhere you get your podcasts. Just remember, nothing in these episodes constitutes legal advice. So be sure to talk to a lawyer, as cases are fact dependent. Hey everyone, this is Mac Pierre-Louis, attorney, mediator, arbitrator, working throughout Florida and Texas. And I have my dear friend and colleague, Jeff Aresti, with me today to talk about Cyber Week, the Internet Bar, and some of the projects that he's been working on. All right, Jeff, how are you doing today?
I'm doing great. How are you doing, Mac?
Good, good, good to see you. And so, as many people might know, Jeff and I, you've been on the podcast for years now, and slowly but surely, you've been taking us through the basic building blocks of the global justice system you've been helping build across the internet over the years. And so today we're recapping, but we're doing it in the context of something that's coming up next week, which is Cyber Week. And I'm going to share my screen just so people can be aware of what we're talking about. Over on odr.info, there's going to be the 22nd annual ODR Cyber Week. That's all of next week, November 6th to 10th. So if you're interested in conflict resolution, mediation, arbitration, anything that has to deal with technology and conflict resolution, be sure to head over to odr.info to learn more about how you can participate. But Jeff, you are always one of the go-to presenters at these events. And so next week's going to be no different. You're going to be there. So some of the remarks you'll be talking about there, of course, are going to be discussed right now. And the biggest thing I think you're known for is, of course, the internetbar.org. That website is right under your name, internetbar.org. So why don't we start from the beginning for people who might not know, what is the internetbar.org?
Thanks a lot, Mac. Cyber Week, which you mentioned at the outset, I'd just like to say I've been part of the Cyber Week program almost since the beginning. I joined a couple of years in and have been part of the steering committee and have made many presentations. This will be an interesting one. I spoke with a couple of the folks that I've been involved with in the last week or two, Ethan Katch and Dan Rainey, and had them reach out to Leah Wing, who's the main organizer now. I got involved with Cyber Week from the very beginning because these are the folks that really saw a global justice system need. The ability to be able to resolve disputes across borders was just an underpinning of a need in the early 21st century as the cyberspace era really took hold. And these were the folks that built the technology, built the training mechanisms, interacted with each other on an annual basis, not only virtually, but they had annual programs around the world where people got to know each other, and really became a wonderful opportunity for me to get to know people who were lawyers, judges, mediators, academics around the world. And each year they get together. And this week coming up, they are getting together again from November 6th to 10th. And in the context of our earliest meetings, I felt that there was something that needed to be done. Most of the focus of the folks in online dispute resolution is on the half of the justice system that relates to the enforcement of rights that are created. Of course, unless there are rights, there's no need to enforce anything. So the other half of the justice system is the creation of the rights, or the determination of what the norm should be for justice. And I really wanted to make a contribution in that area to help build a justice system that would create rights on a global basis. And so we set it up in 2005, and we've been at it since then.
So I'll share my screen. Your website, the internetbar.org, is basically where people can go to learn all about this. And sometimes the concepts of the global layer, right, the global justice layer of the internet, where people from all over the world can get together and basically have access to justice in a way that has not been, you know, achievable throughout all human history. But that those concepts sometimes are kind of difficult for people to understand. Can you speak a little bit again about the whole creation of rights and enforceability of rights at the justice layer? What, if you could, I guess, give it an analogy to help people understand, what basically are you saying?
Well, let's just look at it from the standpoint of who has access to any form of justice in the world. Depending upon which of the surveys that you look at, which have been published by the World Justice Project or the International Bar Associations, the American Bar Associations, all these different groups really come up with the notion that maybe only half the people of the world, 50%, maybe a little bit more, have access to some form of a justice system. Mm-hmm. Where does that leave the other 30 to 50% of the people? I'll give you the examples of the type of people that we work with, and you're seeing them on the screen. These are people who are stateless refugees. They've been torn apart from any home or any economic environment in which they could live in any type of case. They have no access to any form of identity that is acceptable in a justice system, which is really your key to getting any access to justice, is you start with your legal identity and who you are. But for a good third of the world, for sure, you really have very little access to any form of legal identity. And yet, a stateless refugee is a person that has the greatest need for access to some form of opportunity. We're barely giving out humanitarian aid to many of these folks in the world. And yet, you know, think about it just today. You've got wars in different places that are terrible, uprooting people, but not uplifting them. And what we want to do is create opportunities through the technology that exists, the new technology for what essentially amounts to a global computer. To have a way in which to create rights there that works. And young people get that. People in their 20s and 30s are playing around with this technology. They get it. And the older generations need to learn from them, learn from the younger people how to access these new environments, and then begin to build a justice system to support those efforts that would create rights for them.
Yes.
And our starting point has always been intellectual property rights, because that's digital and it's easier to work with. So we've worked with music and art.
Got it. Well, as far as your portfolio goes, all the different things that you've worked on, I see on your website is the Global Futurism Initiative, Peace Stones, B1 World, Data, the Corva Project, and Tech for Justice. Can you, and when you click on that, it'll go over to the full list. Can you go through very quickly what are the things you've been doing since 2005?
Well, the most recent one is probably the most important one, which is the Global Futurist Initiative. And that is the project to engage youth at the policy levels. And they have been involved with us for many years, helping to design our projects. Most people are familiar with the Peace Stones Project who have attended Cyber Week. That was really started at three schools: University of Massachusetts Amherst, Bentley University, and Tufts University. A fourth school, Boston University, came on at the back end and helped create some of the contests that we work with. But essentially what we did was we created the equivalent of an American Idol type contest online. One of the young people that joined us early on, Ruha Devanesson, and then a colleague that she came brought into the program, Molly Dow and Adam Berkowitz, they helped shape a program that we started in Haiti to take it from me going to those countries, to Haiti, and in that particular year to other countries as well, to find musicians, to get them to perform, and then somehow get the word out that we had this music from around the world. And instead, what they did was they said, wait a second, there's all this technology that's out there. There are Facebook contests that are out there. Let's go to Haiti, find some performers, you know, put the word out that we're running a contest. But then after that, let's make it a global contest. And that's what they did. They turned it into a global environment. And the winner of that contest ultimately became one of the most famous performers in Haiti, a fellow by the name of Juanito. So we were very lucky in that respect. But what we were doing was cobbling together, you know, rights based on U.S. copyright laws. There really weren't much in the way of copyright laws that we were counting on in Haiti. Then we looked at global copyright laws and other ways to protect him. And then we gave him his rights so that he could build his own business. So we're trying to give people access to opportunity and then give them the chance to go from there. That's how we started, and Peacestones was the big project. And now the young people that are coming in are suggesting, let's broaden that out. Let's do more than just music. Let's do art. Let's really take advantage of this virtual environment that is being created. And how do we create rights there? So, of course, we need the young people because they know how to navigate the technology. And yes. So the data project really focused in on that aspect of it. The data project, which is done with a partner, Questscope, based out of Jordan, where a gentleman who runs it, Kurt Rhodes, has been working with Syrian refugees for more than a decade in the camps there and working with with the government of Jordan, the top people in the government, as well as with the kids in the refugee camp. And so this man, Kurt Rhodes, is in the middle of it all. And he basically stands for the identity for all of the young folks that are in this Syrian refugee camp. With the idea that he could help these young Syrian refugees claim identity by speaking up for them as though he's their guardian, he allows them to take photography classes, which he organizes with a group out of New York called Lens. And they are able to Lens on Life. So he's able to teach these young kids through the teachers in the New York program how to photograph. And then he goes to marketplaces and sells the photographs that they come up with. And then in addition to that, we've opened up the door to the virtual marketplace, to the Web3 space, where they'll be able to sell their photographs as well. And so in the data project, you see all the different aspects of law that need to be particularly identified, including in particular the identity aspect of it, so that a young person who is sitting in a refugee camp who has no way of claiming any form of legal identity can actually claim their own identity digitally and from there build an opportunity to earn a living.
So I understand that the need for a digital identity is the foundation for you to be able to have access to justice. Do I get that right?
That's a critical aspect of it. And in this new environment, the most important thing that distinguishes it from the current environment is that all of us who have a legal identity in our current environment, we don't control any of the attributes of that identity. We give them up. We give them up to the state. We give them up to the insurance companies. We give them up to all the website intermediaries that we join. We give them up because we essentially click, I accept, to terms and conditions as those identity documents and attributes are given to us. Whereas in this new environment, we control all of our identity attributes through encryption. And so we have to learn how to do that. And that is becoming the real crux of why we concentrate with younger people who seem to have no problem with the cryptography and understanding it and how to use it, whereas an older generation is so comfortable with the existing identity, legal identities that we have, that it's been more difficult to get the older generations to jump on board. Also, as is the case with any new technology, just as it was in 1996 with the internet, here we are again with a new form of identity that is this blockchain identity or blockchain technology, which has as one of its attributes a blockchain identity. It's going to take time for it to sink in and for people to start using it for the benefits that it brings.
Yes. So, Jeff, you say that there has been a turning point in the world when it comes to access to justice and technology and everything that we're talking about today. What is that turning point, and what are your plans now to address it?
The turning point really is the understanding that for a good part of the world, and that includes certainly China and Russia, and you can now see it playing out in wars in the Middle East. There is no agreement that there is some form of global law that the West has incorporated in United Nations treaties and covenants of individual rights and so forth. So all of us, especially the folks who are at Cyber Week in particular, who are peace builders, many of them, the idea that we have individual human rights, it's written, but it's not acknowledged by a good part of the world. And these wars are exemplary to it. And even in our own populations in the West, we are arguing with each other over what those rights mean and who they belong to and how do we express them. So we're at a point, a turning point, where we need to have an understanding of what are the norms for a human society and how we're going to, live together. For me, it's always been very clear that we are here to help make the world a better place. And what that means is that we want to leave it better for those who are coming after us, for our children, for our children's children, for all the young people of the world. And so they need to have a voice in what those opportunities might be. And of course, since I've been at this now for close to 2 decades, we started the program in 2005. I've been saying this for a couple of years, but now it's finally coming together where I'll be able to turn the organization over to young people who will be working with me on what I'm calling my capstone project. And it's an opportunity to really take the Invisibles project and make it real for many people, and many young people from around the world. Using the new Web3 technology, but using it in such a way that the benefits that accrue from participating in it can be used in the existing world or the Web2 world, which a lot of people can get to through their smartphones.
So what's the big project you're working on right now, this moment? You haven't discussed the Tech for Justice or the DeCorva project. Could you go into those?
Well, I will say that the DeCordova project, which is the capstone project, really brings to the forefront all of the principles that underpin the Tech for Justice project. Tech for Justice, to me, has always meant how do we make technology work for justice? The picture on the screen that you scroll past is Jacob DeCordova. Jacob DeCordova was a Sephardic Jew who lived in the early 1800s, who in the history of the state of Texas is probably in the top five most important people. Now, you've heard of Sam Houston, you've heard of Austin and other names that are associated with the founding of the state of Texas, but they all knew Jacob DeCordova. He was a Sephardic Jew who came from Jamaica to the United States. He was sick, had tuberculosis. So in the scheme of stateless refugees, which is an area that I've focused on, he was really in part the 19th century example of a stateless refugee, though he and his family grew up and they were known in Jamaica and in England and so forth. They were part of the 15th century expulsion of Jews from Spain. Jews had never really had a home for centuries. And so the diaspora went from place to place to place, always looking for opportunity. And so what DeCordova did was he arrived in Texas in the early 1830s and he had skills. He was a printer. He knew how to, he started the first newspaper in the Western Hemisphere in Jamaica, which still is in existence and run by descendants of his family today, called the Gleaner. So when he came to Texas through New Orleans in the late 1830s, early 1840s, he saw this incredible land rush that was taking place. So he saw opportunity, no different than we're seeing opportunity with the blockchain. He saw opportunity that here is this Republic of Texas that had declared independence in the mid-1830s, and it was seeking to become a state in the United States. So in that 10-year period, there was this massive land rush of people moving to Texas. He first was a merchant. He went to Galveston and was selling goods to people that were coming to take advantage of the land rush. But then his half-brother joined him, and they went to Houston, and they had set up a land agency. And in the course of setting up that land agency, he did a lot of things. And again, this is, you know, a person who took advantage of the fact that nobody knew how to really own land. There were five different sets of laws that were involved regarding the ownership of any piece of land. And he became the expert of all the laws. He knew how to publish. So he went to the land agency of Texas. There was a general land office. He became integral to that land agency. And as a result of seeing all the maps that were being created, plus doing his own surveying, he created the first official map of Texas, which is to this day considered one of the most valuable maps in the entire history of Texas. He started speaking around the United States, and he went back to England, and he recruited immigrants to come to Texas. So he and his brother at that point ended up owning more than 1 million acres of land. There was nobody who owned more land in Texas at the beginning than this man. So here was a man who was, in a sense, coming from a stateless environment, a refugee moving from place to place to seek opportunity, saw what the opportunity was resilient. And then, of course, you know, things happened. The Civil War came. So all of the property that he had bought and sold, you know, in which he took notes back on, literally was becoming worthless because Texas was on the side of the Confederacy. And so by the time he passed away because of his tuberculosis in 1868, though he became, you know, critically important to Texas, his memory disappeared. His most interesting project, of course, is where I live now, the city of Waco. He founded the city of Waco, and he called it his beautiful daughter. And so we're in the process right now working with the top people in the city to do a movie that will celebrate not only his life, but demonstrate the characteristics of what a stateless refugee can do to not only acquire identity, but acquire assets when opportunity presents themselves. And we will relate that to the blockchain. And of course, young people are coming in to help build this up. And the most important aspect of this new identity is going to be, how do you claim it? How do you identify who you are? And what's the role of a new type of a person in this space, cyber notaries, who will be important to verify the claims that are being made as we move into this new blockchain world?
Well, always fascinating. I get a history lesson as well on top of it. You know, thank you so much, Jeff. I appreciate this. I didn't know much. I didn't know anything about De Cordova, and nor have I ever been to Waco, although it's just a few hours away from me, and I need to go visit one of these days. So thank you so much. What would be the takeaways you want people to know about that project so that they can act upon it?
The most important part from the online dispute resolution world is this. To the extent that you have the knowledge of how to help people get to the truth of the matter, the entire blockchain world is dependent upon the verification of claims that are made by individuals who are then saying, this is truth, this is trustworthy data that I'm putting into the blockchain. Yeah. That's how it works. And when you're dealing with something that requires a level of assurance, such as my identity, who I am, what I do, how good am I at what I do, where are my assets, what's my health, all the aspects and attributes of identity. You have to have a source of that information. If that source is you, the individual, because that's the way that it works, then there needs to be a mechanism by which the verification of the trustworthiness of that source provides some form of assurance that it's true. Well, we have that world today. It's the notary world. And we use notaries for all types of transactions. Well, to claim your identity, we're going to need cyber notaries. And one of the things IBO is doing through its digital pen pal program, which Dan Rennie has helped develop and lead, is going to be teaching people who are currently mediators and currently working in the online space how to play a role, in particular with the stateless refugees and the other folks who are the most vulnerable, to claim their identities first. So we would like as many people from Cyber Week to join our efforts and to help us shape the online justice system.
Awesome. And so if you're listening to this before Cyber Week and you're interested, make sure you go to odr.info to get more information. And of course, the website internetbar.org is where they can contact you and learn about all the projects that you've been working on and how they can contribute. All right. That's it for now. And so thank you so much, Jeff. We appreciate you as always. And until next time, everybody, come back here to learn more about the law and conflict resolution topics on LMI Podcast. Take care. Bye-bye.